welcome to the Moonshine Jesus Show. We appreciate you joining us for this episode where we'll be talking about the Australian sci-fi thriller Monolith. And we do welcome you to the show. I also want to welcome Caleb, my partner in crime here. How are you doing today, yes. Caleb?
Good. I'm ready to commit some crime. what crime are we committing? I don't know.
Trying to make a movie that was never intended to be theological. I don't know. Maybe that's right. I'm not sure. A little bit of housekeeping first. We do want to remind you that we're brought to you by progressivechristianity.org, a great place for all your progressive Christian needs, all kinds of resources there. We encourage you to check them out, as well as us, the Moonshine Jesus Show. Go follow us on Facebook. So you'll have a update anytime anything changes, as well as a long list of our live broadcasts that you can partake in there. And I need to tell you, and maybe particularly so on this show, because there's there's a twist or two that happens. This is a spoiler full zone. So if you're wanting to see Monolith, if it's starting to sound like it's interesting to you, we're probably going to spoil some pretty big moments in the movie. So I encourage you to, put a little pause on it right now, catch the movie, then come back and join us for the rest of the podcast. So before we can jump in, though, we need to be talking drinks, some adult beverages to help us get through this show. I'm wondering, where did you go with this, Caleb?
Okay, so a key point in this is Black Bricks, but this isn't exactly like a blockbuster. It's not a part of an interconnected universe. There aren't a lot of themed cocktails to go along with Monolith or Black Bricks. And so I started looking up black cocktails, and I found one called Black Magic. And I kind of like this because we're not sure exactly what the black brick is, how it works. Yeah. And so I like the thought of black magic. And so it's black vodka. It's cherry juice, orange juice, and maraschino cherry syrup with just a pinch of pearl dust. And so I'll try and get that close. You kind of see the pearl dust.
See the little bit of sparkle going on there. And it is nice and dark. I like that. Yes. We went in a similar route. I did the same thing and decided I need a black cocktail. One of the ones that popped up was a Kentucky coffee, which is bourbon and coffee. So it's not surprising that I would enjoy it. I wanted to darken it up a little bit and I wanted to do something to play with the monolith. So I'm calling this drink a Monolift, L-I-F-T, because it has caffeine in it. I also get dark chocolate syrup, so there's a sugary uptick to it, and it came out pretty dark, not quite as dark yours, but it's a good dark looking drink. And I'm calling it the Monolift because I got a little caffeine, a little sugar, it's in the afternoon here, a little lift won't hurt me, so I'm gonna have that for our show. So cheers to you, sir.
Cheers, Mark.
Yep, and we'll catch you all on the other side of this drop.
Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus. Won't you shine a light?
Welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show. Today we are talking about Australian film Monolith, and as Mark mentioned, we will likely spoil some key moments because there's not really a way to talk about this thriller without talking about some of the twists and turns that come along with it. But if you haven't seen Monolith, here's a quick synopsis. The central character, who is known only as the interviewer, is a disgraced journalist who, depressed and alone in her parents' large home while they're away, starts a podcast about unsolved mysteries in the hopes of reviving her career or at least finding some story to keep her busy. And so she invites listeners to phone in with their stories, and she gets an anonymous tip, and she discovers a strange black brick that has been sent to someone, and she discovers that Flora May, a maid who has received the black brick is not the only one who has received such a brick. And so, Mark, this movie was shot on $330,000 for a budget, pretty much a single location, one single actress outside of some voice actors.
Yeah,
right. So how did you like this? How did you like this approach, this minimalist kind of approach to filmmaking?
I wasn't sure. I was a little concerned, but they executed it so well. I really like, and even beyond that, like I'm a big fan of, I want you to show me it. This is, you know, a movie. Show me what's going on. Don't tell me. That's kind of one of my big things. If a movie spends too much time constantly telling me things, instead of showing it to me. And this does the opposite. All it does is tell you. It doesn't show you almost anything.
Yeah.
It's handled so beautifully, and it just keeps you intrigued. And it's a slow burn, but at least me, I never really got bored with it. I was always on the hook. I was always ready to see, okay, all right, I wonder, all right, that's interesting. What's going to happen next? Like, so I really thought on that budget, with one actress on screen, pretty much in one spot, it went in and out outside a little bit, but unbelievably well done. And that has a lot to do with the actress who played Lily's, her name was Lily Sullivan. She was outstanding, man.
She was incredible. She was engaging, and you could really see a progression. I love films where you can really see the actor progress over time, especially if we're looking at some kind of a mental deterioration. I think it's, I think that's more effective if we see someone functioning as a real ordinary human being at the beginning, and we see that deterioration as we do here in this film. I think a lot of times we don't, whenever that's happening, the actor doesn't really show us what a functional version of the character looks like. But I felt too like it was very engaging, and I kept expecting there to be some jump scares, but there really wasn't any jump scares. But we never lost the suspense. And for me, that really kept me engaged, and kind of as the film moved on, an increasing sense of dread. And I think the fact that there were no jump scares or anything kept that tension somehow burning throughout the film. And so it was kind of intense to watch.
I completely agree. You know, the lack of jump scares, one of the things jump scare does do is release the tension that they've built. And it's sort of the payoff of the tension they've built. And so I think you're right. Them not having it kind of just allowed the tension to have that slow growth and just keep rising and never really release you from it. You were kind of wrapped in it throughout, and there was no real release. They weren't giving you ever quite enough to go, and then just let go of it. You were just caught up in it.
There's no breathe easy moment.
It's a pretty short movie. I think an hour and 40 minutes, something like that. I think, I think what you just pointed out, that never letting go of the tension is sort of necessary to not be much longer than that, because holding on to the tension for that long can wear you out, you know?
It really can, emotionally and kind of psychologically. And it was interesting because it was set up for some kind of jump scare. We see we're in this big modern home, mid-century modern kind of house with windows everywhere. And so, you know, you think at some point we're going to just see outside the house something. You know? And especially
when there was the knock at the front door.
Right.
Yeah, I was just waiting. Oh, something's going to happen. And then it's like, oh, it's a package. Okay. There's a package.
Yeah. Great. Or like whenever she's, do you know the
blinds
down and
auto blinds,
and they're slowly going up. You're like, oh, what's going to be outside the blind? And there's nothing. Or whenever she's in the bathroom. Yeah. When she's in the bathroom and like, oh, she's going to look up behind she's down like hurling. Yep. Like, she's going to look up above at the mirror, and there's going to be something behind her. You know, nothing. Even whenever she's seeing other people's visions, or we're seeing other people's visions, we don't see the thing that was actually scary there. And
it's the whole tell, don't show. And I usually don't like that in a movie, but they utilized it so well to tell but not show. It was great. It was brilliant, I thought.
I thought so too. I thought that the way that they used visuals too, what was was very smart. Starting with the intro, where we fade slowly from this black screen very, very slowly to a microphone.
I don't know about you, but I actually, after about a minute, I paused it and went.
I did too. I did too. I'm like, is there something on my screen? What's on
the screen? Something's wrong with my video. I don't understand why I'm not seeing anything. And I literally went to the timeline of the streaming part and it pointed at it and saw, oh no, there's going to be visuals, but it goes on so long. And then they slowly fade in the pattern of a microphone, which was a cool move, but it was, they were so committed to it that I literally thought, I guess my video player's messed up.
No, I did too. But where I paused it was right when they started to show the pattern of the microphone. It was just starting to fade in. I'm like, is something wrong? Do I need to restart it? Did it not buffer or something? And I'm like, no, there's something on the screen. Like, is there? Yeah. I'm like, oh no, this is right. It's
exactly. Exactly.
So that kind of filmmaking, along with I think the vast openness that we can see from the home, I think is powerful and communicates a lot. I also think the way that they handled audio was
really
incredible, very smart. And I was listening with headphones, you know, and so I had very aware of the audio, and especially whenever we switched to a vision and the audio changed from the phone to very kind of
more open,
very, very loud, and you could hear it in a different way. I thought they did a great job. Yeah,
it was brilliant.
So I thought that people have described this as a lesson or a masterclass even in filmmaking on a micro budget. And I think there's a whole lot to be said about how they use the budget that they had. Mark, I'm curious though. We find out as time goes on that the interviewer has a connection to these black bricks. I'm curious about the connection, but more curious than that, I want to know when you figured it out that that she had a connection to this, because always what we'll say, you'll say is, well, starting around this point, I started. So I want to know when you figured out that the interviewer was involved.
It was later than you might suspect. It was the first time we saw the birthday party before she mentioned a black brick. I was like, I'm thinking, why in the world are we seeing her? I mean, someone sent the birthday party. That's kind of out of the, and I was, you'd only send it if it's going to make a connection here. That's the only way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until she said black brick that then I went, oh, you're the family. You're the family that stole the possession from the house cleaner and then fired them. And I thought, I honestly thought, no, that's too, there's just no way that's what they're doing. And it turned out it was exactly what they were doing.
It was. Yeah. And so it took me a while to piece it all together, but here's one of my questions with this, Mark. Why do you think that the interviewer didn't remember Florame, her housekeeper, who I mean, even if she had visions and parts of her memory were blocked out, this had been a housekeeper who was with them for an extended period of time. She had grown up with, in part, the Florame's daughter, who was around her age and who she ended up blaming for scraping the table. Right. Why do you think she didn't remember Florame or that family?
Yeah, that was, it kind of gave me a problem too. And the only thing I could think of is, you know, some folks just, and I'm one of the folks, our younger childhood, my memories aren't real clear on younger childhood. I'll have little moments that I remember, but there can be people who were like involved in my life for, you know, pretty much for a year or a couple of years, who I have a vague recollection of them, but I really couldn't give a name to them. I really couldn't anything. So that's the only thing I could figure is that she had a traumatic event on top of just being a person who's, you know, historical memory maybe isn't as robust as some folks are, because mine certainly isn't. You know, I could tell you the name of my kindergarten teacher, but I couldn't tell you my first grade, second grade. I could tell you second grade, but I mean, I go back and think about people who I spent a lot of time with, and I couldn't tell you most of their names. So I think maybe that's
what's paired with the trauma that maybe she blocked parts of it out. Okay. So Mark, another question that I want to make, I've got several questions I need help discerning while we're in the geek out section. I'm also curious. So we find out that there are kind of replicants, duplicates who come along and maybe replace people. Do those replicant, is that just an experience of the interviewer, or is that something that happens with all the bricks, or is that something that only happens if bricks get destroyed?
They didn't really answer it. I came to the conclusion that it was just bricks that get destroyed that releases something.
That's where I landed too. Yeah.
Or calls something, because there is one shot in the movie that does tell you, in my opinion, that we're supposed to assume this is some kind of an alien technology. There's an outside shot of the house where in a very cloudy sky, you see the outline of very large monolith, like these black bricks floating above the house, which I assumed was monitoring from alien who's in some way connected to these bricks. So, and I, you know, there was one time when she asked someone, have you tried to break it? Have you tried to destroy it? And the person sort of dodged the question. And so that's why I feel like that must be what they were kind of going for, is that, you know, breaking it causes some response, whether it's that this duplicate forms because of the technology, or if it signals the aliens to send a replicate to take care of whatever's going on. I mean, is that where you ended up?
Or
is
there that's where I landed too. And I've got a ton more questions, but there's one more I have to ask before we get out of this section.
Okay.
And
all right. We'll see.
I want to know, the version of the interviewer that we get at the end of the film, is that the original interpreter or the original interviewer, or is that a replicant? Who do you think we've got?
You did a great job of stealing one of my three questions, so congrats to you.
I made a list of questions I thought Mark was going to ask.
That was one of them.
In season three, I haven't stolen any questions, and I've been real disappointed in myself. This time, I really tried.
You did it really well. That was one of my three questions that I was curious that I was going to ask you about was that one. And honestly, I still go back and forth on it. Watching the show, I was pretty certain that it was the original interviewer that won the fight. But then there's little things that I go, I don't know, you know, there's a pretty dramatic change immediately in behavior, which a person who's gone through real trauma wouldn't have an immediate change. It'd be a slow kind of role. I think there's something going on with the way that when the real interviewer was going downhill, her turtle also was going downhill, and how almost immediately with the new person, the turtle starts eating again. Yeah, it feels like maybe they were trying to tell us that the duplicate is the one out. And maybe that's the whole scary thing of what's going on, is that these aliens are going to take over in this sort of slow way where they just slowly start replacing humans. And you won't ever know who's been replaced, that it might not be the person that you've loved, you know, as a child their entire lives. And I don't know. I think maybe it leans that way. Did you have a strong feeling one way or the other?
I think it was the replicant. So two things related to my decision were the turtle because we also got that narrative of the grandfather who wasn't eating. And then all of a sudden he started eating, but he had a personality change. And so right. I thought the turtle starting to eat similar way might be, yeah, the replicant. I also think that it seems like she had made the decision not to move forward with telling the truth on her podcast about her family's role. And the first thing that she does when she gets back in the house is go in and start the podcast. And I mean, it could be that she just wanted to tell the whole world what she had learned, but
right.
I think it was the replicant. And I think it's because I don't think it's going to be a slow takeover. I think it has to do with that article that she discovered, the viral disease traveling through sound. I think the aliens were kind of waiting until there was a large enough podcast following, and they're going to spread the viral disease
through
sound waves through the podcast. Just like we're doing right now.
Theory. We weren't supposed to talk about that, man. We're not supposed to say that out loud.
That's right. It's a secret. They've already heard it.
Much like you ruined my question, you just ruined the secret of the podcast.
Yes. Okay. Hey, as much as I would like to delve into all the things about this, we need to talk about theology and politics. So let's take a quick break. Let's come back to our Theopolitico section.
Welcome back. You've joined us for our Theopolitico segment. So Caleb, I want to start off with a kind of a large question that this, I think, is trying to make a comment on, but more of a secondary comment. And that is the sort of isolating experience of being like a modern day content creator. You know, she spends a lot of time alone trying to create and having to put together and plan and all of that. And I'm just curious, one, they did a pretty good job of showing how isolating it can be. What are your thoughts on choosing a lifestyle where you intentionally isolate yourself in real life, but expose yourself in digital life that much? Is that a healthy thing? What do you think's going on? Because we have a lot of folks that are doing that and are actually making great livings off of doing that. Right. What do you think about it as a lifestyle choice and what that does to us?
I think it's hard because one of the things that happens whenever we're sharing everything online is that we're being vulnerable without the other vulnerability of relationships. And so people can say in comments, say whatever they want, and they risk absolutely nothing, as you are risking absolutely everything being vulnerable. And so I think one of the things that's really interesting is that, you know, study after study shows that the more you use social media, the more depressed you can become. And you can have your perceived social isolation, they call it, it goes up the more you use it. And in part, that's because we're using it not as real community most of the time, but as networked individuals. So we're using it in our silos. And scholars who talk about new media talk about this all the time, that it's our silos, our networked individualism, that leads us to feel isolated, even though what we're really doing is connecting with more people than it was possible
ever before.
Right. So I think it's dangerous if what we're doing is isolating ourselves from true community. I think it's fine in moderation, you know, or it can be fine as long as you have healthy boundaries set up. But if we're talking about living completely by ourselves, just engaging in this way, in this one way where we're being vulnerable without community, I think that can be real dangerous. That's my thought. How about yours?
No, I completely agree. I think it's just like anything else. It's the balance that you have. And it also has to do with who you are and understanding yourself. I know folks don't ever believe it, but a severe introvert like me, that kind of isolation, if it's measured well, is very healthy for me. I'm a healthier person and more readily able to engage with community if I have it. But I think to your point, that those boundaries have to be established. There is something very dangerous about isolating yourself that much, particularly when you're getting this false feedback that you do have this community. And like you said, it's really a one-way community where you're being vulnerable and the other side is can pretty much be whatever they want. And a lot of times are just a number and aren't actually engaging in any way. So I think that can be really, really dangerous. And it's something that you, if you're doing that as your choice of how you're making your living or what you're doing with your life, that you got to really consider how am I balancing this with real interaction with people that causes a healthier growth for me personally. But here's a related question though.
Yeah.
You know, since COVID, which I think part of the reason this movie was even made was they felt like a lot of us would be able to relate to it because we were also kind of isolated to some one degree or the other. You know, there was a massive uptick necessarily in Sunday services that were broadcast. And almost all of us who had any success whatsoever in doing that have kept our broadcast, even those who maybe didn't have a broadcast beforehand. And I know just from my own experience at my own church, some folks pretty much mostly, or at least primarily participate in church now that way. There's a noticeable number of folks who aren't there in person and who really almost never show up. They do from time to time. So kind of continuing on, is that healthy, particularly in a spiritual growth, spiritual development kind of space? Is that healthy? And either way, what should we be doing to address if it is healthy? What do we do to play more into making it as healthy as possible? If it's not healthy, what do we do to provide what is necessary to help a person?
I think it's good that people are able to engage in whatever way is comfortable for them. And, you know, I think we've seen one thing I was actually talking to a group about this morning was, you know, in my community and other communities, it seems to also be maybe some of the older congregation who has made the switch. People who pre-pandemic wouldn't have wanted to touch social media with a 10-foot pole. And post-pandemic, that's the primary way that they engage with faith communities, whereas our physical faith community has grown with a lot of younger people. And I think that that's really interesting. I think, though, that the balance becomes you cannot build community in the same way in a digital space. It has to be built much more intentionally. I think the danger comes whenever you're just a consumer of like a worship service. So like if you're just sitting there watching a worship service, I think that is not the same thing as being physically present because you can't build relationships in the same way. So it has to be built a lot more intentionally because you're not just sitting down next to someone in a pew and saying, oh, how are you? How was your week? Something like that. And so I think churches that use live streams that are engaging in digital ministry have to make a very intentional effort to include people. So to have online components, to be building relationship among the digital community and connecting that digital community to the physical community. And so I think it can't be done haphazardly. I don't think it should be done just as like, hey, this is here, you're watching it. Right. but I think efforts for community building are important because it's that authentic relationship building that really is at the heart of spirituality. That's my thoughts on it in a nutshell. What do you think?
No, I definitely agree. I don't think most of us are doing a very good job at figuring out how do we get the people who, for whatever reason in their life, it's best or healthier or easier for them to participate via a live broadcast. I think there's still a lot of work to be done on how do we engage them in a way that still helps them understand that they're part of the community and feel like they are, and that they're even participating in that time that you're all together. It's something that's going to have to develop more and more because this is not going to change. And I can, you know, there's already churches that have formed that are all online where because of COVID and they have, and you've got to figure that out. I want to sneak in one more question here. Yep. We're running out of time. And this one's not so much theological, although it could be considered it. So our main character, the interviewer, her career is, you know, as we start in sort of an unstable place, and the podcast is her, basically it's her best hope to reboot her career. And in that very first episode of the podcast that she creates, she re-edits audio.
Yes.
To make it more sensational. Yes. Even after she had told the person, I'm just trying to get to the truth. I only want to tell them what you, right. what you're saying. With journalists competing nowadays for fewer and fewer jobs because they're mm-hmm. being eliminated, and media yep. corporations with them valuing profit over in-depth reporting, how frequently do you think that that kind of sensational journalism, even from folks who want to be really solid journalists, how often do you think that is part of the media that most of us consume?
I think it's almost always a part of it. And even if we watch, I mean, just look at the headlines. I mean, headlines have always been designed to be sensationalist. But whenever we are, say, sitting there watching the 24-hour news cycle and we hear what people are talking about and you look at the banner running across the screen, frequently, mm-hmm. they, you know, we don't even really match up. And so I think mm-hmm. part of the thing as more and more people are getting their news online is having some clickbait, you know, getting people mm-hmm. to your site. That's part right. of what gets the funding for the journalism. That's part of what gets people to read the article. And so I think we are living in an age where almost day by day we are seeing an intensification of this real response to try and get people to the sensationalist response, I suppose, to get people to click on things. So I think even journalists who are ethical and trying to do the right thing, I think we see a lot of this, even by editorial teams to try and get articles read or stories listened to. What do you think? Do you see it as well?
I couldn't agree more. I completely agree that we see that happening, and it's just increasing. Even the good journalists are using, you know, like you said, clickbait headlines where you go, oh, that's interesting. And then you click it and you realize, oh, that's, you were using clever wording to say it in the wrong way, or anything as simple as right. that, where yeah. they can. So I think it's on all of us consumers to be more and more increasingly aware that that's yeah. going on, and to, you know, educate ourselves in recognizing when that's happening, and finding sources, the resources that do it the least a bit, you know?
Yeah.
Which, like you said, is almost none it's of them at hard. This point.
It's hard.
But it's so important. When we're looking at a movie, and I had several more questions, a movie that also yeah. is making commentary on conspiracy theorists, it becomes yeah. even more and more important for us all to be better and better at recognizing
yeah.
when people are using sensationalism to give a story mm-hmm. just so that they'll get more click-throughs so they can make more money.
Right.
It becomes really important in the age of conspiracy theorists that we are very aware of it and keep getting better and better at recognizing. Listen, we could go on and on, but we don't want to miss our favorite segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment. So I'm going to let that be the last question. We're going to have a quick drop here and we'll come back on the other side.
Welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show, where we were talking about Monolith, and we have moved into our final segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment, where we ask each other questions to try and make our co-host look stupid, or we at least try to get an answer to something that we have been wondering about. So, Mark, here's a question that I have for you. The interviewer is in this house by herself. And she does speak to people on the phone for the podcast and a few friends and family members. But okay. I'm curious, one of the consistent things that we hear is that people see visions before they receive their black brick. So I'm curious, Mark, did the interviewer have visions? Did we see some of her visions? And if so, what were they? And if not, why not?
Well, during the movie, that thought occurred to me, maybe about halfway through the movie, as we learned that people tended to have visions before they received a brick. And I was like, wow, what if this whole movie is her vision? Mm-hmm. Like, and then we found out that like the visions are almost always violent, you know? And I was like, okay, well, there's nothing really violent going on in what she's doing here. Yeah. Maybe psychologically violent to a degree, but it's nothing really violent. So ultimately I arrived at the conclusion that she is not having a vision. We don't ever really see what her vision was or wasn't, that she probably had it as a child. And that we just never get to know what it is. And maybe because she's the main storyteller and she doesn't remember what it was, or she would have kind of had some clue, you know?
So you think the brick that she got as a child was actually her brick?
I think it could have been, yeah. I kind of feel like it might have been. Partly because the brick has a symbol in it. We learned during the show that this German art dealer has had them scanned and figured out what's on the inside. And what's on the inside is a bunch of characters, and each brick has different types of characters. And it turns out that the brick that they had a character in it that she carved into her dad's grandfather's table. And so part of it was that there were symbols in each brick that represented the person who received the brick.
Yeah.
And so since she carved that into the table and it was in that brick, I feel like, it was her brick. Maybe she left it outside and that's where the housekeeper found it or whatever. But I think we're supposed to understand by the end of it, when she moves that runner across the table and you see the symbol that's in so many of the other things that she had received that were personal to her, that based on the fact that that there is a symbol in each brick that represents the person, I kind of think that she had it as a child. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I wonder if it could have been her brick, and maybe she isn't having visions because she doesn't have that brick with her anymore, or maybe it's because it is the housekeeper's brick, and being around the brick once she got it showed her that symbol, and she carved it in. I wondered if, as we were seeing the visions that the people were describing, if she was also experiencing those visions, because there is the one where the lady's talking about going through her office and getting ready to jump out the window.
Right.
And we cut to that scene where we're walking down the hallway about to go to the window. Once she's finished describing, the interviewer seems kind of lost, distracted, as if she is somehow visualizing something. So I wondered if somehow her visions were seeing the other people's vision. But I wondered myself too at one point. I'm like, could it all be a vision? Are we going to find out like at the end that this was all some kind of a vision and she's really at work or something? That's not what we discovered. So I don't think I don't think it was either. So I don't know that we solved that question.
But no, I'm not sure that's solved.
Open ended.
I'm going to ask a question that I also, it's a two-parter, of course. And it's also both sides are probably unsolvable because I don't really have an answer. Yeah. What is the black brick? Mm-hmm. Possibly more disturbing and concerning, why did they receive the brick by throwing it up?
uh, Yeah.
That was the one most unbelievable thing for me, that they almost lost me when a person gave a gold brick size object comes from somewhere within them and out their mouth. I was like,
yeah.
All right, I'm going to go with you on this, but that, y'all, I don't know. I don't know. So what is the brick, ultimately, and why does it come out of their mouth?
So I suppose it symbolizes the guilt of wrongdoing, and so each of them expresses something that they feel some kind of guilt for and aren't really willing to engage with until this externalization of their guilt is given to them. Although I wasn't real sure as to why the aliens chose that particular method. Like, if it is aliens, like, why are they choosing people's guilt to get the, is it because people are easier to manipulate? No, I like that. It's because people are easier to manipulate around guilt. That's why churches use guilt to manipulate people because they're easier to manipulate. And so then ultimately the replicants can come through. I don't know why they come, why the bricks come from inside them. I don't have a good answer to that. Do you have a good explanation for why they're putting these things out?
I don't have a good explanation. Here's where I ended up landing, but still it feels incomplete. I think that it's a really, and I hate to say this because so much of the movie is really, really good. I think it's a really poorly executed metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about our phones bricking, and people talk about it being the black mirror. And so black brick, I'm wondering if the brick is supposed to be symbolic of something that takes over our lives, that has us inside of it in some way, and that it's supposed to somehow be a representative of the phones that we have with us all the time that take over our lives. Cause it does talk about social media so much in this and how we engage in it. And that, that coming out of our mouth is supposed to be somehow symbolic to the way that we create what's good or bad in it, the way that it is. And I like the monolith floating over her house could be a like metaphor for, I don't know, Meta or Google or somebody who's like the controlling that wants us engaged and is trying to make sure that we stay engaged. It feels like it was could have been a clumsy metaphor that never really pays off. And frankly, that's kind of where I ended up. It's like, I think this is a clunky metaphor that they never quite knew how to pay off and just decided to kind of leave it more of a mystery. I don't know. Am I reaching too much?
Well, you know, at least it's an explanation.
I don't know if it is or not, actually.
I think I like that. I think that's a good thing worth exploring. And so maybe that is to the listeners, it's a good incentive for you to go and watch Monolith and see what you think the black brick is. And we would love to have you answer that question for us.
Please.
I'm not sure we quite got there. This was a fun one.
I am quite sure that we did not get there.
we didn't get there. This was a fun one. There was a lot of interesting things. A lot of interesting.
Yeah. It was a happy surprise. We weren't sure what to know, what we were going to think of this. It was kind of like it's just dropping on American television. It's an Australian movie, and so we decided to take a chance on it, and I kind of think it paid off.
It isn't always the case. No. Hey, but we're gonna pivot, and we're not going to do kind of an obscure movie next week. We're going to talk about a big one that I think we've both kind of been waiting to see, right?
Big time.
Yeah. So Dune Part 2 is coming out this week. And just in case you're living under a rock or something, Dune Part 2 is the second part of this Dune series. And so you might want to check it out if you're not familiar. Dune was a 1965 novel. We've had an 80s adaptation. Then we had an adaptation a few years ago. This is the second part of that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I can't wait to see it, Mark. How about you?
I am beyond excited. Dune was one of my favorite books growing up. Okay. And so I've been waiting for someone to do it well on the screen. And fingers crossed, man. I'm very hopeful that this is going to be it.
This is going to be it. We're going to have so much fun talking about it next time. So hope everyone can watch. And we'll see you next time on The Moonshine Jesus Show.
Moonshine Jesus, go by the sky. Moonshine Jesus.